Folks, welcome to the March 10th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT, 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed worldwide live at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week in honor of Women's History Month is one from his book, Cries for Justice, is entitled A Tribute to Mothers. And here with us also today is co-host Bob Pelesny and co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. And we have a special guest in the studio, Dave P. and Mike Griffin, who's here from Decatur, Illinois. So here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers Interest News.
Company officials announced a deal between an Illinois power cable manufacturing plant and a Texas energy company that's expected to create 1,450 jobs in Illinois and boost wind energy projects. Georgia-based Southwire Company, which has a plant in Flora about halfway between Salem and Olney, Illinois, and Houston-based Clean Line Energy Partners, LLC, said the Illinois plant has agreed to manufacture 500 miles of overhead transmission cable for a grid designed to harness wind energy. The Rock Island Clean Line Transmission Project, which will start in northwest Iowa and end in Morris, Illinois, is expected to deliver 3,500 megawatts of renewable energy from states with good wind resources, Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, and South Dakota, to Illinois and other states to the east. The project is expected to cost nearly $2 billion. The maximum benefits developing renewable energy and potentially lowering utility costs in Illinois are still a few years away, but construction could begin as early as 2014 for the three-year labor agreement. Officials with Clean Line need to sell the idea to landowners and communities affected by the construction. The Flora plant currently has a little over 100 employees, but the deal is going to create many hundreds of more union construction jobs. Bob?
Thanks, Tom. In Chile, a women's rights march ends in fierce clashes. A march in the country's capital, Santiago, for International Women's Day ended in chaos as protesters clashed with police. Over 10,000 Chilean activists marked International Women's Day with a march on downtown Santiago, highlighting social equality for women in the South American country. Participants flocked from a number of feminist, social, and union groups as they demonstrated together, calling on more women to take political action and occupy positions of power in Chilean politics. The protesters began to clash with police when they tried to move barriers set up around the presidential Moneda Palace. Authorities fired tear gas and used water cannons against the crowd. Also, in Zimbabwe, the police banned the ZCTU Women's March for International Women's Day, and that's the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. On Thursday, police in Bulawayo banned a march that had been organized for women from Zimbabwe's umbrella labor union, the ZCTU, to commemorate International Women's Day. Anti-riot police were deployed in Bulawayo Central, some with AK-47 rifles. More troops were stationed near the ZCTU headquarters, where they searched commuter omnibuses and innocent civilians. The ZCTU women decided to gather at their offices instead of marching and clashing with police, who threatened to unleash the riot squad if the women came near Drill Hall where the chiefs had gathered. Barbara Tanyanweya of the ZCTU Women's Advisory Council said police have personnel to beat us, but none to protect us when we need them.
Oh, well, those women can be dangerous, you know.
Yes.
I guess.
I guess.
Okay. As many as 100 million workers participated in a one-day strike, India-wide general strike on February 28th, to protest against the socioeconomic policies of the Congress Party-led United Progressive Alliance government and to express support for a 10-point charter of demands. The demands include actions to contain rising prices, halt privatization, and an end to government complicity in employers' systematic violation of labor regulations. The petition also called for equal pay and rights for the large number of contract workers employed in industry and the public sector, and the provisions of social benefits for the vast majority of India's workers who toil under sweatshop-like conditions in the so-called unorganized sector. Tom?
U.S. service companies expanded in February at the fastest pace in a year, helped by a rise in new orders and job growth. The Institute for Supply Management reported last week that its index of non-manufacturing activity rose to 57.3, up from January's 56.8, and the third straight increase. Any reading above a 50 indicates expansion. Expansion in the service sector coincides with the lowest unemployment in 3 years, 5 straight months of solid to strong job growth, and rising consumer confidence. The trade group of purchasing managers surveys roughly 90% of U.S. companies in all sectors outside of manufacturing. That includes retail, construction, financial services, healthcare, and hotels. 14 of the 18 industries that the Institute for Supply Management tracks expanded in February. Real estate, rental and leasing, transportation, warehousing, construction, hotels and restaurants, and information technology firms were among those reporting growth. According to the chairman of ISM Survey Committee, the group's members are reflecting growing levels of optimism about business conditions and the overall economy. Bob?
Here's a story out of Britain. It was, I found it in these times, reported by Michelle Chen. And it says, blacklisted as troublemakers, UK construction workers struggle for justice. For years, they wondered why they kept getting turned down for jobs, even when they seemed well qualified. The workers might have all just chalked it up to bad luck if they hadn't eventually discovered they were at the center of an extraordinary conspiracy. An investigation by the UK Government's Information Commissioner's Office, ICO, in 2009 revealed that some of the country's most prominent construction firms had worked with a secretive company, the consulting agency, to create a blacklist of workers with a history of being suspected troublemakers or labor advocates. As fresh details have recently surfaced in the British media, the scandal has taken on shades of a British crime thriller, a Sunday tabloid, and a treatise on the English working class. The government investigation found the consulting agency trawled extensively for background information on about 3,200 workers and established a clearinghouse to help employers keep work sites free of subversive elements. Major industry players used the database to scrutinize workers' past labor disputes, from demands for back wages to complaints about unsafe working conditions. Following a media expose in 2008, public outrage flared and workers organized to hold corporations accountable, but today their demands for justice are still unmet. The blacklisting of trade union activists has been known about for a long time. Many people have complained about it in the past, but since the consulting agency database was exposed, we finally have the evidence to prove it. According to the ICO's findings, as reported by The Guardian in 2009, files on individuals included comments such as Communist Party, ex-shop steward, definite problems, no go, do not touch, orchestrate a strike action, and lazy and a trouble stirrer. As well as paying an annual fee, firms also paid for requesting information on individual workers.
Well, as far as those subversives go, remember, you may have Bolsheviks breeding in your potty house.
Okay. Yeah, you know, that's interesting, because I saw a story. It mentioned that the British Intelligence Service, MI5, MI6, was involved in this, actually.
That's what they say, yeah, that this information was supplied by the police and or security services to this private agency.
They did the same thing during the mine worker strikes in Britain against Arthur Scargill, and it was Margaret Thatcher, you know, the Iron Bitch, and Ronald Reagan. And to prove that that coalition actually happened, the last prime minister to just step down is living proof that Thatcher and Reagan had a love affair.
You're talking about Tony Blair?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I wouldn't argue with that. Okay, in calling attention to job creation is equivalent to economic growth, working people across Europe on February 29th, led by the European Trade Union Confederation, are on a day of action in opposition to the European Council's adaptation of budget discipline treaty, quote unquote. In mobilizing the same day everywhere in Europe for the first time, European trade unions are reacting with anger about the ETUC's General Secretary Bernadette Segal. Today's day of action will feature demonstrations, work stoppages, and information postings inside workplaces and government institutions, stating that the European Summit's Treaty of Stability, Coordination, and Governance is a straitjacket that will plunge the European Union and the Eurozone into a free-fall recession. In the United Kingdom, British trade unions use the day to gear up their defense of the National Health Service for massive rallies that occurred on March 7th. This is last week. And in Greece, workers continued their resistance to the government's austerity legislation with a three-hour work stoppage this coming week. And even in Georgia, that's Georgia, the country, not the state in the United States, trade unions will join the day of action with a rally at their parliament in the capital, Tbilisi. Tom?
Hey, on February 29th, a number of tornadoes swept through Illinois and surrounding states. One tornado's toll was most severe in Harrisburg, Illinois, where entire blocks were flattened in the town of some 9,000 residents. The winds were strong enough to devastate neighborhoods and to actually blow the walls off of some rooms at the Harrisburg Medical Center. That storm was part of a violent system that ravaged the Midwest and South, killing at least 13 people in four states. The Federal Emergency Management Agency last Monday began surveying the damage from the tornadoes and other severe weather that rolled through southern Illinois. They started their investigations in Harrisburg, where six people were killed and over 100 injured by the tornado that authorities say was 200 yards wide and packed 170-mile-an-hour winds. Besides Harrisburg, a tornado also touched down in far southern Illinois, just north of Paducah, Kentucky, that same day. Governor Pat Quinn has issued a state disaster declaration, and the information therein will be made available to officials to help support a request for federal disaster declaration. Bob?
Thanks, Tom. Here's another story came out of In These Times, and this one was reported by Mike Elk. Talks about worker occupations in three states yield successes, but the counterattack begins. In the last few months, workers in three different states, at the Sirius Materials Factory in Chicago, at Century Aluminum Factory in Ravenswood, West Virginia, and at AT&T's regional headquarters in Atlanta, have engaged in occupations that quickly produce small results for these workers. These actions, one an actual factory occupation, the other two highly visible encampments outside company facilities, have underscored the enormous potential or direct action to give workers leverage in negotiating with employers. But just as Congress quickly outlawed the type of auto industry sit-down strikes that were so effective during the 30s, anti-union groups are now advocating measures to counteract the success of these recent protests. The backlash has begun. We've talked briefly before about the House Resolution 327. They say also last week a Georgia State Senate committee passed State Bill 469, which would ban picketing outside the home of CEOs and give the company a right to ask a judge to force protesters, whether union or non-union, to stop picketing outside any business. If these members do not stop picketing after a judge's order, the courts could fine individuals $1,000 a day, and any organization or union that sponsored the protest would be fined up to $10,000 a day. The bill would severely limit the ability of unions and other groups to bring aggressive anti-union employer actions to the public's attention.
Yep, the ruling class are definitely frightened, and we're going to be talking more about this later in the show with Mike Griffin. We need to do what they did in the 1930s and earlier in this country, in the labor movement, is defy these unjust laws in mass, and it's what Mahatma Gandhi did in India. They're from the famous film that was made in the early 80s with I can't remember the main actor who starred in that film, but the scene where Gandhi is taken into court and he's fined so many rupees, he just simply says, "I refuse to pay." And that's what they need to do. Fine us all you want. We refuse to pay.
Yeah, and how about Thoreau?
Henry David Thoreau.
Yeah. And I tell you, one of the tactics I really like from South and Central America is roadblocks.
Oh, yes.
Just think about closing down interstates.
Oh, you know, there's a story about some African-American trade unionists who shut down the Dan Ryan in Chicago. And, you know, they called a SWAT team from three counties. I mean, it was like that was like a major emergency as far as they were concerned. Heaven forbid shutting down traffic on an interstate, you know. But nevertheless, I mean, boy, you know, that is a thought as far as a tactic anyway. Not that we're advocating it here, mind you. We merely report the news. So anyway, we're going to go to a little Jim Hightower here, and we'll be right back.
I'll take you spelunking inside Rick Santorum's head today on Hightower Radio. Let's go spelunking in Rick Santorum's head. There, we can probe the inner sanctums of his brain and discover his deepest thoughts. But once inside the Santorum skull, we find that there are no deep thoughts at all in here. Only acrid shallows of intolerant fundamentalist theology and the slippery moss of right-wing ideology. This explains why Santorum, whose name, after all, does derive from the same Latin root as sanctimonious, has now come out as the full-throated standard-bearer of the GOP's Christian extremist constituency. Like an angry street preacher of pietistic correctness, he literally sees the devil at work in government policies, liberals generally, and Obama specifically. Obama's environmentalism, he cries out, is phony theology, an attack on God's will that man has total dominion over earth and all things within it. He rejects birth control as the devil's tool for promoting mass promiscuity, and he wails that government must stop funding prenatal checkups, for they're the invention of liberals who are trolling for babies to abort. Indeed, the mere suggestion that an abortion might be legitimate for any reason whatsoever causes an eruption of fetid swamp gas from the narrow creases of Santorum's mind. Even a victim of vicious rape, he preaches, must view her pregnancy as, quote, the gift of human life, and accept what God has given to you. He devoutly intones that although this is a fetus forced on her by the horror of rape, it is her child. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only does such dogmatic fanaticism shape Santorum's worldview, but it would also define his presidency. Forget separation of church and state. He says his own religious doctrine must be enthroned to help shape proper public policy. All hail Santorum, theocrat in chief.
We now come to that portion of the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week. Or, I'm sorry, from his Cries from Justice, A Tribute to Mothers.
Throughout all time, women have trod alongside men across the sod, across the river valleys deep, over mountains high and steep. Both genders built our land, you know, as side by side the two did go. Yet once the saddest thing we saw, when fools wrote our civil law, was that a woman could not vote, though wood and water she could tote. Then some fiery heroine stood to teach us that was just no good. From Diana to Aphrodite, Lily Langtry to Anne Feeney, goddesses and muses' daughters weep and sing to stop the slaughters. But more and more women's voices will be needed to win their choices. Maybe it's time that motherhood took us over for our own good. A woman leader would bring the peace by making all the false wars cease. She would bring all our children back from an abyss so deep and black. Motherhood could balance our bills and make sure Grandpa gets his pills and teach all kids their ABCs and wipe out most of the world's disease. And no, a woman president would not have an Iraq. Men could not live without women, and women not live without men. So let's seek true equality entering this new century. Work hard for a world that is good. Trust the instincts of motherhood. A Tribute to Mothers was written at the Poets' Loft in Champaign, Illinois in the spring of 2006 and was brought to you live today, March 10th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Workers from several plants that manufacture auto parts for Flexengate, a $3 billion global corporation based in Urbana, will share their stories at a community forum about problems at the plant, including allegations the company doesn't follow proper safety procedures. Flexengate plants in Urbana and nearby Vetersburg, Indiana, use hexavalent chromium, a known carcinogen made famous by the movie Aaron Brockovich. Flexengate is now the 15th largest leading manufacturer of metal bumpers for pickup trucks and also makes vehicle interiors, lighting, and plastic exterior parts. The company is owned by Shahid Khan, who remains closely tied to the University of Illinois, even as he became known nationally for a $760 million purchase of the Jacksonville Jaguars football team. Workers from Flexengate plants will speak about their experiences at the plant, which includes serious safety concerns. The event is co-sponsored by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, the Graduate Employees Organization of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, the Service Employees International Union, Occupy Champaign-Urbana, the Undergrad Graduate Alliance, the United Auto Workers, and other campus and community organizations. So that's today, and it's at 1 p.m. over at Channing Murray Foundation, the corner of Oregon and Matthews. So again, that's today at 1 p.m., the corner of Oregon and Matthews. So I think it's going to be a really good event. And,
oh, Dave?
Yes.
I didn't hear any building trades unions that are sponsoring this.
No, but I got something for the building trades here.
An event. Oh, April?
April 19th, yes. 2012.
Hitler's birthday.
Oh, that's
the,
right.
The anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombings. That's when this big Republican conference is, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. What a coincidence it is, Bill. Yes, save
good
the date.
Things on April 19th.
Save the date, April 19th, 2012. Right to work won't work in Illinois. Join the rally Thursday, April 19th in Champaign from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. And this is going to be at the Hilton Gardens, the corner of Kirby and Neal Street. Mitch Daniels, the infamous Republican governor, is going to be in town, and he's going to be at the Hilton Gardens speaking.
Celebrating Hitler's birthday.
Yes. But anyway, what's interesting, the Hilton Gardens was built non-union, so I wonder if the local Republicans chose that specifically for Mitch Daniels' talk. But anyway, the billing trades that are calling on all our union brothers and sisters to join as the keynote speaker, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, at the Champaign County Republican Lincoln Day dinner. Boy, what a mistake. Governor Daniels recently signed legislation to make Indiana a right-to-work state. Right-to-work doesn't guarantee any rights. In fact, by weakening unions and collective bargaining, destroys the best job security protection exists, the union contract. So come on out and give Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, a warm welcome as he comes into Champaign-Urbana on April 19th from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Hilton Gardens, corner of Kirby and Neal. And we'll be giving you updates every week on the Labor Hour to remind you of this event that's coming up here. So,
I mentioned that he was Bush's budget director that underestimated the Iraqi war by about $200 billion.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was only going to be like $1.2 billion or something and pay for itself with all the oil.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Okay, well, with that note, I guess I'll just welcome...
Dave.
Yes.
Murder by proxy.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry, Bill. Okay. Before we go off to our guest in the studio, Bill Grill has something really fun to share with us here.
It's how fun it is, but I was speaking to a guy on the phone the other day whose name is Emil Chiaberry, and he's just directed this documentary called Murder by Proxy, How America Went Postal. And according to the YouTube page, the film explores the basic question of what brings a seemingly normal person to the point of committing mass murder. It examines the complex interplay of personal and societal factors leading up to the incidents of workplace massacres, starting with the earliest post office massacre in 1986. And if I can get my Skype stuff working, I'll have an interview to play back on this shoe. On this show within the next week or two. But right now I'd like to go ahead and just play you the trailer for it.
Okay.
Okay. And remember to keep the mic on, Dave, because there's a couple things I have to read here.
Okay.
Here it goes. There, go, Dave.
Okay.
Mothers away from their children. He took fathers away from their children. On the other hand, I understand why he did it.
If you ever wondered why. If you ever wondered who.
People don't just flip out and go crazy.
Any of us can.
If you ever wondered how.
And be affected by a mass shooting, and we have no way of predicting it.
Nobody knew what to do. People were breaking out windows.
Between 850 and 1,000 people per year annually are murdered in the workplace.
To become a mass murderer.
How going postal was born and how
it spread out to other workplaces.
It's spreading. It's shopping violence. It's malls. It's universities.
If anybody ever knew
true
about
story.
The abusiveness that happened at that post office.
You start suspending him. You kill his morale. You take the money out of his pocket. You do false charges on him. You ruin people. And that's what they did.
He would tell me that he was getting phone calls at his house with managers harassing him.
We did a study. Going postal was a myth.
Past 5 years have added a bloody new dimension to the public image of the friendly mailman.
Instead of killing someone,
hidden epidemic.
And it came from the top and it went down to the bottom.
When they went in his wallet, they found $1 left.
There's something they're trying to hide here.
You guys sold us out. You let these people do this.
The workplace massacre was described as the work of a madman, but there's a story behind a story.
Key Element presents a new documentary directed by Emil Chiaveri, Murder by Proxy, How America Went Postal.
Okay, Bill, you want to just tell us a little bit about what this this film's about, certain postal workers?
I haven't seen it yet, and I think it goes beyond postal workers and workplace. I think it's more about
workplace bullying and harassment and...
It's something that I've experienced. Many people have. It reminds me of Marty Condalis because he often,
yes.
Our friend from Chicago, yeah. The electrician, he's often mentioned,
yes.
Discussed the emotional aspects of work. And I don't know, it goes beyond work too. I think it's just the capitalist society in general and the expectations that are laid on people. And in fact, it reminds me of incidents I had this week with a old friend of mine who's hit really hard times lately, and he was pretty much bipolar anyway, mm-hmm. and has had some problems in the past, but in more recent years he had steady job, had gotten married, been an AA, involved in a church. This week, the sheriff drops him off. Oh, I got to meet the new Piatt County sheriff. Mm-hmm. Drops him off at my house because he was camping on somebody's private property.
Camping on somebody's camping. Okay.
Yeah, see, he'd been reduced to moving back to his parents' house. This guy's 50 years old.
Yeah.
And living in their camper, and I can just tell by looking at him that he's now in really, really pretty well losing it.
Okay.
And it's due to the lack of work and the work, and the whole thing. I mean, I'm not that tightly wrapped myself, and the last couple of years have been pretty tough. You know, I can relate.
Well, so. We can all kind of say that to some degree or another, probably. But anyway, what do you got there, Bill?
Hitler's real name was Schicklgruber.
Okay.
He changed his... I thought Schicklgruber was the guy in The Great Dictator.
Probably was.
Well, that was Adolf Hitler's real name was Schicklgruber. Oh. Probably when I was in junior high school, I learned that he changed his name to Hitler so people would remember it better. I mean, you can remember Hitler better than Schicklgruber.
In English, they pronounce it Karl Rove.
Okay, on that note, I want to introduce one of our guests here in the studio, Mike Griffin. And Mike, welcome back to Labor Hour. And you're here to talk about the nuclear industry since this is the first anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. So, Mike, take it away.
Oh, thanks, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and hopefully give the public a little bit of enlightenment on what's happening in the nuclear industry. A lot of people think it's the first anniversary of Fukushima, but it's much more than that because Fukushima is still ongoing. And the reason I say that is we know now from people monitoring our West Coast, Canada, clear out into Idaho, that there's a lot of individual isotopes that has, through the jet stream, has made it to U.S. shores. They're finding it in milk in California, on vegetables in Oregon, and all up and down the coast. So, Fukushima is not over with by any means. And there may be even a much larger disaster just about to unfold here in the near future. And the most curious part of this is the absence of any major stream media reporting on any of the higher levels of celcium and tritium, on vegetables and fruits and what can be considered high volume isotopes and hot particles, if you will. And obviously, there, at some point, there's got to be an impact on the workers that are harvesting those crops, that are growing them, and people who are also eating the produce that's being affected by this increased radiation.
Now, you know, one of the issues that I think is interesting is considering how safe and unsafe, I should say, and dangerous nuclear power is. How is it that, you know, it's going strong, I guess, and even recently in Georgia, I guess the first nuclear power plant to expand in 30 years has been issued. What's the dynamic behind that, Mike?
Well, the dynamic is that there's an all-out push by the industry to expand and to start building new plants. They set the stage in America now where corporate money controls everything, and the Citizens United decision by a right-wing court that has been politicized even plays a role in this. And, the Obama administration, one of his main campaign contributors was Exelon, who owns 11 of the nuclear facilities in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, come hell or high water, we're going to have more nuclear power and damn the torpedoes. They don't care what the public thinks.
Well, that's the interesting factor here. I mean, here these things are a danger to public safety, but how is it this is getting pushed through?
Well, it's getting pushed through because both sides of the aisle are bought and paid for. We've never seen, and I've never seen it in all my years, a political climate so corporate controlled as it is now. They're not only hitting us on one end by buying the right to pollute and to murder people and kill people, make people disappear. They're hitting us on the other end by destroying our Constitution and our ability to speak up.
Yes, that's a good point, which I want to definitely go into here. But first, you told me something before the show, which I was really shocked about. The Clinton Power Plant, which is the nearest power plant to Champaign-Urbana in Clinton, Illinois. And you mentioned... tell me a little about that. First of all, you told me how much it cost to build, how much it went over budget, and how much the recent corporate company bought it for.
Well, I think the Clinton Nuclear Power Station, which I've worked in a number of times, it's one of the newer plants and probably one of the better plants. Originally, I think that was scheduled for like $800 million in construction costs, and it went clear up to around $4 billion by the time they were done. Make no mistake, it didn't cost Illinois Power. It cost the ratepayers and the taxpayers. And they turned around when the Exelon Group formed this limited liability company, which is a licensed legal corruption. And whenever they formed this group, spearheaded by Commonwealth Edison, they bought the Clinton plant for $22 million.
So who made up that difference between... over $4 billion and $22 million.
Well, we paid for it to begin with, and I mean...
get to pay twice for it?
Illinois Power could have given it away and probably wouldn't have lost a dime on it.
That's just amazing. So, I mean, that tells you right there that nuclear power, I mean, in of its essence, is it's not very cost-effective. I mean, now, of course, for the corporations it is, because you told me before the show as well that compared to other energy, that nuclear power is much, much cheaper per kilowatt hour to produce, even though the rates they charge customers are the same.
Didn't Ready Kilowatt say it was going to be too cheap to meter? Remember Ready Kilowatt? Oh, the light bulb head got electro. You don't remember Ready Kilowatt? Oh man!
Well, the cost to produce nuclear energy, particularly in a cycle where you buy them used, or you build this group or this coalition, is relatively cheap. Now construction costs are high and remain high, but they'll offset that with public funds. The taxpayers will wind up paying for those plants in Georgia. And what they don't get, the ratepayers down there in Dipstick, Georgia, will foot the rest of the bill.
Okay, so this with the Fukushima disaster, I mean, it's of course, it's spread much beyond the shores of Japan and stuff. I mean, what would happen if we had a similar incident here? And could it possibly happen here as well?
Well, let's talk about what's going to happen next at Fukushima. And nobody can know the hour or the time, but... basically what happened on reactors 1, 2, and 4 is they had a total meltdown, and then that caused ensuing explosions, which spread hot particles and nuclear radiated waste far beyond that 12-mile limit, evacuation limit that they set. They know that there's hot particles as in major cities as far as 25 to 30 miles away. But what's still unfolding with Fukushima, and you have to remember how the Japanese government and TEPCO, the company that owned them, reacted. Lies, lies, lies. And now, as this nuclear fuel is burning in the bottom of that containment, which has about a 10-foot-thick concrete steel-reinforced floor, when that penetrates, and it will eventually, and hits the soil underneath, you're going to have more steam explosions, and then you're going to see massive amounts of radioactive steam hit the air and more hot particles. And there's two types of exposure that you get from radiation. One of them is acute exposure, where it's a large dose over a short period of time, which can kill or cause a lot of damage to you, make you sick, and you'll eventually die. The next type is somatic, which is a lower doses over a long period of time. But both kinds does cell damage and mutations, and Chernobyl's a good example, where now children are being born with no hands, no feet, no faces, I mean, all kinds of things. That's going to be the scene in Japan down the road, too, although it takes a few years for that to mature.
Hey, Mike, I was just wondering, you said you've worked at the Clinton power plant. Do you work on the outages there?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I worked on construction. I haven't worked on any outages.
Well, see, that's another problem, too. Our plants in this country, 100 and some of them, all of them are around a 40-year lifespan that they were designed. And they've upgraded the turbines and stuff to produce more, which means they're running things harder, you know. Mm-hmm. But they've done very little to upgrade the components like the reactor and stuff like that, only when they have to. Years ago, an outage was typically 8 to 9 months. They went through everything. I mean, they put in thousands and thousands of hours with thousands of people. Now an outage is 10 to 14 days.
And those are usually 12-hour days straight through, no days off.
For the length of time it takes to change out that fuel, that's the only time they spend. Yeah.
But I was just thinking about
items,
all that overtime, too, people working it.
Yeah, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
But the safety-related items that used to be repaired and taken apart on non-destructive testing and examined was across the board in 9 months. Now it's a percentage of them.
I got a little bit of work out of the outage. I got to build the parking lot that was out there. Did you work on that last one? You might have parked on my asphalt. Yeah, that was outside. That was outside the fence, so I didn't have to worry about any background checks or anything.
Okay.
Well, a lot of our plants, the location itself is a real problem. Like Songs 1 and 2 in San Onofre, California, is right at sea level, right on the coast, near one of the. It is along the biggest fault line in the northern United States.
Well, I mean, New York's lucky they didn't hit that
Indian Point in New York.
Yeah,
right on Al-Qaeda. The Hudson River at the water level.
Yeah, they could have crashed the planes into it. Supposedly, though, they're supposed to be able to take a hit from a 747.
That's what they claim.
That's
the old theory that the media put out there to make people feel better about it.
That's just the containment building. That's all they claim. They could hit, like, the screen house and stop the water from coming in.
Terrorism is not an issue.
Yeah.
It's losing control of the reactor is the issue. Losing the water pumps. None of it will cool the spent fuel and the burning fuel and the containment. Losing the diesel backup generators.
Right.
That pumps the water to cool these in the event of a seismic event or some other type of a major disaster. That's the problem. Indian Point's a good example, because Indian Point is 25 miles from downtown Manhattan, the largest metropolitan area in the United States.
And it would be east of Manhattan, so it's likely that the prevailing winds
it's north and
a
little bit west.
Okay, well, west is pretty close, too.
But here's the problem. How could you actually evacuate a city of that size, plus New Jersey, Patterson, Newark, all of them. How could you evacuate them? You can't.
It would be physically impossible.
In the event, that's exactly right, and they know it. They know it. That's why they've kept that 12-mile evacuation limit for that Indian Point plant, in spite of a lot of people telling them it's dead wrong. Here's the thing. When something like this happens, when it happens, and it's going to in this country, they're not interested in evacuating you and me. Now, you could go in there and clean up the nuclear waste like Japanese's poor and unemployed are doing right now, but don't you dare ask to be a survivor out of this incident. That's solely for the rich and the devious. You'll see guys like, you know, the hairpiece, the Donald and some of those goons being swept out of New York, but it won't be the average working person.
Well, here's what I want to say also about an average working person, Mike. Now you're saying these shortages or these outages are a lot shorter than they used to be. And I know people that work on them. And I'm going to tell you one thing. I bet most of them, 98% of them are going to be real pro-nuclear power. And right now, there are people in this town, building trades workers and their officers, who are salivating at the thought of them putting the second reactor in at Clinton.
Yeah, be thankful you got a job. I mean, that's a normal phenomenon. But what's really important here is taking a look at these reactors around the country. You got Three Mile Island, which is still an issue. It's still sitting there cooking. There's a huge, thick glass. I've been in Three Mile. And that thing is still burning, that core is. Wow. And they have to monitor the radiation every day. But guess what? It's not for a week or two, but it's for 2,000 years. That's once you let that genie out of the bottle, it's out. You can't put it back. Both plants in California at sea level. Turkey Point in Florida, Crystal River, sea level, right on the ocean. I mean, a tsunami could wipe them out very easily.
And they have all this radioactive waste sitting there in pools because we don't have a repository.
They sit in the Susquehanna River at water level, both of those do, which drains the entire eastern seaboard down into the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, from what I remember at the Clinton Power Plant, that pool should be not much higher than the Clinton Lake is there. Even though it wouldn't be like a tsunami danger. But.
Well, actually, the spent fuel pool is. It's up on the second level.
Oh, they put that on the second. Okay.
Yeah, they do. And that has to have water constantly pumped over it as well. And those spent fuel rods have to have a minimum of 18 feet of water on them at all times over the top of them to avoid excessive radiation. And any time that the water circulation stops, that water's going to heat. It's going to turn to steam, evaporate off. Sending steam out, and there's another problem right there. The vents that were designed to relieve the pressure in the containment building in Japan failed. They were designed by General Electric, who designed the ones right here in the USA.
Oh, I got a little story. You know the screen house where the water comes in?
Yeah.
Okay, I was on a crew, and we were down there stripping the forms. And it was like ceilings like about 30, 40 feet high. And we're up there pulling off this plywood, and we're up on these scaffolds and working all the time. And one day, a labor foreman comes down and says, "Man, you guys got to quit smoking so much weed down here. The white hats are smelling it." The superintendents. When that plant was being built, man, there were electricians tripping. There was one guy that got fired. Because he was so drunk when he came in, he tripped over the railroad tracks right after the brass alleys. We'd go out to the parking lots to clean the parking lots. That's laborers' jobs. And you could have made a living on the beer cans out there. People were always going out at lunch and doing whatever they wanted to. See, they didn't drug test when they built it. And they probably couldn't have got it built because they needed so much help to do it. At that time, and that was the early 80s and late 70s, early 80s, and it's amazing. I was completely amazed. Everybody, there was things going on out there. They were raffling women, raffling off cocaine, raffling off guns.
Man, yeah, I missed all that good stuff. I went in there really hung over a few times, Bill. But I mean, I missed the good stuff.
Yeah, you were you worked a while for as a steelworker,
permanent iron worker.
Okay,
yeah.
No, okay.
Did you do like them CAD welds?
Right now, though,
I worked on the containment building. Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, I used to like to watch those. I worked nights, and they'd shoot those CAD welds off at night.
Yeah.
See, okay. That's one of the big myths about nuclear power, is people believing that that containment has to be breached in order to create a nuclear disaster. If you just lose control, that's what happened at 3 Mile. It was a valve that failed.
Right.
And a meter, you know, monitor. They misread it.
Yeah, Mike, and also you had something else you want to talk about today, and that's this recent House resolution that just is coming up here.
Just like we're not being told about the radiation on the West Coast, it's not good to harm, you know, to let the public know what's going on, because they'll panic. And that's what they fear most. When 3 Mile had its incident, the NRC lied, the public servants lied, and the company lied. That could have been much worse. There was no evacuation then. There won't be in the next one either. So now, to make sure that we don't get out there and inform the public about what's going on, they just passed the bill H.R. 347, which is supposedly a federally restricted building bill. But what this thing does, it gives Homeland Security the right to designate certain areas as restricted areas, especially if there's Secret Service involved, like, say, a rally for this dumbass from Pennsylvania that's running for president, you know, Santorum.
Oh, the frothy mixture.
If you go there and disrupt that, you can be charged under a felony count and given a year in jail and a fine. If you went to, say, where the president's going to be, and you went in what they designated as a restricted area, they could, and the same thing would happen to you. Even if you just entered the area and did nothing, and you were told not to. So it's just like when George Bush was isolating, you know, his campaign trail and everything from the public, so the protest wouldn't embarrass him. So now they're saying, we're going to leave it up to Homeland Security. And the Occupy movement is calling this the Anti-Occupy Bill. Yep. Three Republicans is the only ones that voted against it. All the Democrats voted for it. And Obama's going to sign it into law. This is definitely one of the biggest infringements on our First Amendment rights that we've ever seen in our lifetime. And it's actually shocking. And all this here is left up to restricted area. Now, if someone gets injured during one of these protests and you're in a restricted area, what they determine is a restricted area, they can charge you with a felony and 10 years in prison and a massive fine for being in the area. It's all up to the federal prosecutor. And we know how those beady-eyed little geeks react to protests. There's no question in my mind. But you know, what we really need to remind ourselves of is the founders of our country said in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the right of people to peacefully assemble and to petition government for the redress of grievances. I mean, this Congress shall make no law. The arrogance of these people is unreal. Have you heard any of this on ABC, NBC, CBS, Vox? No.
Of course not. I mean, look what they tried to do to the RNC 8 in St. Paul. And that was a state law, that state Homeland Security law, that they were charged with the felony for organizing demonstrations. Now, it also, you know, recently, just this week, they moved the G8 meeting from Chicago to Camp David, to a fortress.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So they, because they were worried, because the opposition, us, were getting together and going to plan. They were terrified of another Seattle WTO, and that's what they had
to do. And this is despite all those repressive laws that Rahm Emanuel, as mayor of Chicago, has passed.
Well, I'm really disappointed.
At the same time that he passes a bill up there, $1,200 fine for demonstrating at the same time frame.
I'm really disappointed because they were finally going to have something with a conveniently located.
for me to go to.
Yes, here's another thing. These restricted areas doesn't just apply to federal grounds and buildings and stuff where we've always had protests on federal grounds, you know, the national parks and stuff. It also occurs to things that are considered meetings and gatherings of national significance. And it's Homeland Security that gets to determine that, like the G8 summit. Some of these things where we normally have large protests.
It should be pointed out that one of the Republicans that voted against us was Ron Paul. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed it was. Yeah.
Should we point out were any of them happened to be named Tim Johnson?
They all voted for it. Everyone okay. was there.
And I have a correction here. Hitler's father was named Schicklgruber. And Mr. Schicklgruber's stepfather was named Heidler. And Hitler's father took the name Heidler, but somehow it got recorded down to Hitler. So Tom was close. And Dave, did you want to hear that that Rush reggae version of Working Man?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, let me get her.
I can have a lot of fun with that name Schicklgruber, I'm telling you.
Yeah, but the British... supposedly, the British promoted the idea that Hitler's real name was Schicklgruber, which I do believe was the name that Charlie Chaplin used in The Great Dictator, wasn't it?
Okay, let's hear that clip.
All right, man. This is Rush. Longtime listeners of the show will know this song. It's called Working Man, except they start out doing it with a reggae groove, man. It's pretty cool. Live in Cleveland last year, Alex Lifeson's playing a YBS-355 Gibson guitar.
We like it up at 7 years. I go to work at night. I got no time for living years. I'm working all the time. It seems to me I can live my life better than I think I am. Yeah. I guess that's why they call me the working man. They call me the working man. I guess that's why.
Okay, that was Rush playing another version of Working Man, our theme song. Okay, Mike, you had some last things to say about this bill?
Yeah, we've heard from a lot of legislators here recently and candidates, you know, let the states decide on what their laws should be, and it shouldn't be federal laws. Here's what happens when you give the power to the state to determine what our Constitution should say. In Wyoming, Dick Cheney's old stomping ground recently, they tried to pass a bill there, a representative by the name of Miller, that they would be allowed as a state to declare a state of emergency, to create its own standing army through subscription, get that, print their own currency, and acquire military aircraft, suspend the legislature, and establish martial law.
Now, that can't be legal.
In Wyoming, it is.
Okay.
Will they take over the nuclear installations there? The missiles as well?
You got to understand that most of them politicians' girlfriends out there, bah.
Okay, on that note, this has been the Illinois World Labor Hour on WFT 90.1 FM from Champaign, Illinois, and webcast live worldwide on the net at WFT.org. And we want you to stay tuned for Occupy Radio. And also, I forgot to mention earlier in the program, check out Labor's Worldview TV on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television, coming up tomorrow and Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. And we've got the hosts of the Occupy Radio here on WFT. We interviewed them, and they're going to be on the air tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. Comcast Channel 6, Labor's Worldview. Okay, thanks for tuning in, and be safe this week. And we're going to leave you a little John Lee Hooker we thought might be appropriate to segue into the Occupy Labor. I'm sorry, the Occupy Radio 3-hour program. So here's John Lee Hooker Jr. with People Want to Change. Thanks for tuning in, and power to the people.